Hey, Media People podcast listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, then you're going to love our newsletter, appropriately named the Media People Newsletter. Delivered right to your inbox, each edition is a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or go to mediapeople.behive.com. That's B-E-E-H-I-I-V. Thanks for listening to the Media People Podcast, lively and insightful chats with the people who power the media industry. I'm your host, Victor Genova. For more episodes, you can go to mediapeople.ca or subscribe wherever you get podcasts, including youtube.com/@mediapeoplepodcast. Views expressed by participants are personal. Ian Dallimore is Lamar Advertising's Vice President, Digital Growth, and General Manager of Programmatic. But his path to out-of-home advertising didn't start with a typical agency job. A New Orleans native, Ian's original plan was to be a pediatrician. He studied medicine at Louisiana College while on a basketball scholarship. An injury nixed this, and he transferred to Louisiana State, where he graduated with a degree in marketing. He moved into minor league baseball, taking marketing roles with the AAA affiliates of the Atlanta Braves and the Houston Astros. Ian pivoted into out-of-home advertising with Lamar, rising from strategist to where he is today. Ian Dallimore stops by to chat about growing up in New Orleans, running marketing for minor league baseball teams, why Michael Jordan is the GOAT, and working for Lamar Advertising. And be sure to check out Ian's podcast, the Digital and Dirt Podcast, featuring conversations with inspiring and influential thought leaders from the advertising world.
My role is to basically disrupt and innovate a company that's been around for over 122 years. Lamar Advertising is the largest out-of-home company in the U.S. Again, founded in 1902, mainly roadside billboards with about 300,000 billboards, over 5,000 digitals, and then over 30 airports and a handful of other transit assets. But it's a phenomenal company that is, even though publicly traded, is still run like a family, like it was in the very beginning. So as the VP of digital growth, part of my job is to handle the programmatic aspect of our business. The other portion of the job is really to focus on innovate and change, whether that is how do we utilize data in out of home? How do we pair ourselves with CTV, online, mobile, social, and really just, again, look into the future of our media and how it has a place, whether that is interacting with wearables to what does it look like in a driverless car universe, and really just kind of future-proof the company.
Ian, I'm really glad we were able to do this. I know we've been planning on doing it for a while, but we missed a couple dates on it. And I'm excited because this is a cross-border recording. So let's go back to the beginning. Where are you from?
Yes, originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, as we were just kind of jokingly talking about Mardi Gras coming up in a couple of weeks here. It's a beautiful city to be from. People talk about New York being the place that has food and culture. I would argue that New Orleans is by far more culturally diverse in food and music and just fun.
Give us some insight into what life was like growing up in New Orleans, just because, like you've said, a lot of people know the area from Mardi Gras, but you've also suggested, too, there's a hell of a lot more to it than just that event.
Yeah, it's, you know, growing up, amazing mom and dad, both worked very hard. My mom's from San Antonio, my father's a New Orleans native. So really, really ingest a lot of what music is. My father loved music. He was a photographer. But just fully embracing just that is New Orleans. It's hard to explain unless you've been here. But everyone, you know, growing up had two brothers that we were very active, very sports-driven kids, but also had a desire for culture and music and photography. So I was very blessed in having a very unique childhood compared to most. Real quick story is, you know, growing up, my mom was Southern Baptist, my dad was Catholic, so he didn't always go to mass, but we would go to our Southern Baptist church and listen to the pastor and then come home and throw our church clothes off. And my dad was listening to like Led Zeppelin and others in the garage. So, you know, got the full context of both church and music.
Yes. Gospel and Jimmy Page right there for you.
Yes, sir.
What were your hobbies or interests growing up? You already mentioned sports, but is there anything more to it than that? Or which sports
baseball was my sport, played since I was very little, picked up playing basketball over time. But yeah, very blessed. Me and my best friend, Jeff Gordon, haven't seen him in years, but him and I both played second and short from the time we were 8 up until high school. So baseball was a big part. Basketball was a big part. My brother is actually a college basketball coach. So, you know, always trying to, you know, emulate him and learn from him. But yeah, I would say baseball and everything that I learned from that sport really kind of set me up in the role that I am today, which sounds kind of silly that a sport would help you become, you know, a VP within a company. But that was kind of my passion every day. Always had a ball, baseball in my hand and a glove.
Funny that you bring that up, because that's the way it is in sales. You kind of have to help your peers, but at the same time, you're competing with them too. I like to call it co-opetition.
You know, it's one of those things where baseball is that sport where there's so many different options based on where the ball is hit, based on, you know, who's up to bat, based on who's on base. So it really kind of helps you think about multiple ways on how to react to things and how to, you know, make decisions. And then most importantly, just being held accountable and being a strong teammate. And I think that truly helps you kind of evolve your position in the workplace.
Okay, so who was your NBA team, or which NBA team did you support growing up? Because the Jazz left New Orleans to go to Utah. Did you follow them there? Or
yeah, a little bit before my time, but yeah, I mean, Pistol Pete Maravich was the legend that went to LSU, one of the greatest basketball players before his time. Growing up, I was honestly more of a college basketball guy, more probably due to what, you know, you watched on TV. So I was a big Duke basketball fan. Coach K followed every one of his books that he's written, the journeys that he's been through. But, you know, again, the baseball side of it, it's unique in New Orleans because there was three TV channels, and you either were a Braves fan, an Astros fan, or a Cubs fan based off of if you had cable or you didn't. We didn't have cable growing up. So therefore, I was by default a Houston Astros fan and still am today.
What about the Pelicans though? When they came to town about what, 20 years ago or so?
Yeah. I, you know, biggest regret is I didn't buy season tickets courtside because they were super cheap year one. And then again, being a Duke basketball fan, having many of the front office and players on the court being former Duke guys, I love supporting the Pelicans. We bring the kids down a few times a year to watch Pels games. And yeah, I mean, they're the ultimate underdog with folks like Zion and others. They're a blast. And again, it's not about the basketball game when you go, it's really about the culture and the music. I mean, you'll see Lil Wayne on the sideline. You'll see Trombone Shorty. You'll see all of these phenomenal musicians and chefs sitting courtside, which is a bit different than a lot of NBA games.
Well, they beat my team, the Raptors, the other night. I think it was something like 135 to like 105.
So,
yeah, I know you guys. I don't know if you guys are having a good season, but you definitely had a great game that night. Let's take a step back, though, because you mentioned the Houston Astros. Yet Cal Ripken Jr., a lifelong Baltimore Oriole, was one of your influences growing up. So why him?
Yeah, I think for me, and it says a lot about my character and who I am, you know, in my office here, I actually have a signed jersey from Cal Ripken, which was a gift from a good friend. You know, for me, it was really about Cal's work ethic. You know, obviously, he's looked at as the Iron Man in baseball, you know, played the most consecutive baseball games ever out of any baseball player. So I think I, you know, being a second baseman, obviously, you kind of look through the league. Ryan Sandberg was the other option. But again, I think it was Cal's work ethic. I thought it was really cool that he had a brother, you know, having a brother that was 13 months younger than me, who was also a baseball player. I thought that was kind of cool. Like, hey, Eric, maybe one day you and I will go play in the MLB like Cal and his brother. And then probably the fact that his dad was so involved in his life, you know, not only as a baseball player, but as a coach, he was the guy, right?
Another hero of yours, Michael Jordan. I know we know he's the greatest of all time, but what attracted you towards him?
First off, I love the fact that you acknowledge that, and anyone that ever disputes that needs to actually take a look a little bit deeper into stats. I think by de facto, I'm 44. So at that time, if you weren't a Michael Jordan fan, then you probably just didn't like basketball, or you, you know, you like the other side of basketball, which was the Detroit Pistons, which was, you know, the bad boy side of things. It's the story again, and it sounds like I'm kind of an underdog that has a chip on its shoulder, which I do both. But the whole story about him getting cut from his high school team, whether that's true or not, it's still up for debate. But I think what I loved about him, and it really is who I am as a human and what I love to do with my job and just beyond, is just constantly changing your position and evolving. You know, the nickname my mom gave me when I was little was the future, because I would always second guess everything. So for Michael Jordan, for me, on a deeper level, it was really watching someone revolutionize the game of basketball in a time where it was hard fouls, don't drive hard to the lane, especially when you're playing certain teams. And then on top of it, you know, this was the days of the Celtics and the Lakers kind of dominating the NBA, and it kind of became boring until you had this, you know, this young kid from North Carolina come in that looked really cool with his sneakers that no one ever wore, and he would get fined, and then his short shorts, and then doing things that just defied gravity. It was everything as a kid that I've developed in as, you know, a human today and a grown man.
His Netflix documentary, one of the things I found most interesting about it, and you're talking about how he revolutionized the game, but also how he revolutionized things off the court as well. And Phil Jackson had a hand in that too. But I remember there was one episode they were talking about how during halftime players would go out for a smoke.
Yes.
Like, and they were the ones that kind of had to wake the players up to that. Like, you're not going to play very well if you're smoking, let alone smoking at halftime. How are you going to do the other half, back half of the game? So it wasn't just that. I imagine you saw, I know the answer is yes, but you saw the movie Air, right?
Yes.
I could not believe that was such an enjoyable Michael Jordan movie that barely has Michael Jordan in it.
Absolutely.
And you already mentioned it too, because one thing he did revolutionize with Nike was the fact that I had no idea, something, what was it, 40 or 50% of the shoe had to be white in the NBA?
Yep.
And if
or
it was more,
you
fined 5,000, and they were the ones that said, screw it, you're going to wear red and black, and we're going to just pay the fine.
Yeah. But I do have to say this about the movie Air, because I'm a huge book reader, and you know, it's based off of Shoe Dog.
Which is a good book. People should read that. Yeah.
Yeah, you should read it multiple times. It's actually sitting on my desk, hand out to people often. But, you know, one of the things that Shoe Dog and that journey in Nike was, is they kind of told half the story about, you know, the why. Also being a sneakerhead, I think it's a really cool backstory, you know, because nobody wanted to wear Nike back then. But again, they created something that really excited Michael Jordan and excited the brand. And again, changed even the way that sponsorships were given. I mean, no one was paying that type of money to an NBA player, let alone at the time they were paying tennis players like Andre Agassi and others. So yeah, definitely read the book and skip the movie if you haven't seen it.
I'm a big NASCAR fan, and Michael Jordan started a team with Denny Hamlin a couple of years ago, 2311 Racing. And if you get a chance to watch the NASCAR, it's kind of like Formula One Drive to Survive, a NASCAR version on Netflix. I want to say I'm only two episodes in, but it's very heavy on Michael Jordan's team. And I wouldn't say he plays a major role in those two episodes, but he pops up quite a bit. And there's one instance where they show the new shop that they're building, and they show just how much influence in the architecture and design Michael Jordan had, and how he's changing things on the fly, like a lot of influence. It's not like he just parked his money on the team and put his name against it, and they used his brand to gain sponsors. He is very hands-on with that.
Yeah, 100%. And if you go even deeper, I'm actually a closet NASCAR fan too. We used to go to four races a year, but former UNC player Daughtry has a racing program as well. And he's been on the racing team for quite some time, and he's a Ricky Stenhouse guy. So yeah, it's fun to see these Carolina boys go back to the roots, and that is racing.
Reigning Daytona, like Ricky Stenhouse Jr. is your reigning Daytona 500 champion. Might make
exactly.
It, I mean, depending on what happens in a couple of weeks, might be back to back.
Love it.
Okay, so what was your first job ever?
Yeah, so first job ever. Again, work ethic was key, especially on my mom's side. She instilled it in my brother Eric and I early on. You know, there was this place called Celebration Station that had go-karts and had, all these miniature golf and arcades. And it was, growing up in New Orleans, lower middle class at best. I say all the time, my mom was like, hey, if you want to go to Celebration Station, they had a bracelet. I think at the time it was like 10 bucks, which was a lot of money back then. And she was like, I'm sorry, we just can't afford to do that. Whether that was the case, or I believe it was more, she was just driving us. My brother and I started this lawn cutting service. I think we had five lawns and we had to borrow our lawnmower. And my dad said, hey, every time you use lawnmower, you're going to pay me an X fee and then you're going to clean it up and bring it back. But that really was the infancy of, ownership and really kind of understanding like, okay, value, time, money. Is this worth going to buy the $10 bracelet? And at the time, as I'm 11-year-old, absolutely it was. So that was the first job, I guess the first official job with a, that you actually got a check and not knocking on people's doors. Again, being a baseball guy during football season and at the playground, it was, they had a concession stand. And I was like, well, anybody can serve hot dogs and pour fountain drinks. So very early on, spent a lot of days in the concession stand as well, freezing during football season, selling hot dogs and nacho cheese and all the things that you can get, Airheads. But yeah, those were the first two early jobs of my life.
Do you look back on your lawn cutting service and say, oh my God, I was planting the seeds for a sales career? Because something you didn't touch on is that sales was a big part of that job there. There are a lot of people that could have said to you, Ian, no, you're not going to cut my lawn. I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah, for sure. I think, and this is something that I learned from my dad early on. It's really, and it's what I do today. I say I would be a terrible salesperson, but from a storyteller early on, you had to sell the why. You had to sell the why. Why let an 11-year-old come cut your grass, or why allow this person to have the responsibility to cut my grass or to sit in this concession stand and represent the playground? 100%. I think people don't understand that every day of your life, whether you're actually talking or the way that you present yourself or the way you shake someone's hand, you're constantly selling something. Today they're called influencers or brand innovators, but from day one of when you can communicate and really kind of present yourself in the world, I think everybody has some sort of selling aspect of what they do. I've just over the years have just become this, I'm told, a really great storyteller. And I think storytellers come from being passionate about what you do and really caring about who you represent or who you work for, whether that's yourself or in my case today, Lamar Advertising.
But it also comes down to appreciating a good story as well. Because when I brought up Air, you were quick to say, okay, what, the movie's all right, but that's half the story. You really want to read the book. So you've seen two sides of that and you know which one is a better story.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, depending on who you are, had I never read that book before, you would say, wow, that's actually a pretty amazing book or a pretty amazing movie. I think that, yeah, I mean, you're spot on. The ability to know both sides of something, or as I like to challenge my team, just being curious and learning more. I think that that's the key to success in life for sure.
Okay, so let's talk about your university and college career, because if everything had gone as planned originally, I doubt you'd be at Lamar, because you were looking at med school. You wanted to be, was it a pediatrician?
Yeah, I had growing up, I remember, and I think, again, it's funny, everything leads back to baseball, but my pediatrician actually lived right next door to, at the time, the very famous Will Clark, first baseman, played for the Giants. For me, it was, hey, it had nothing to do with the medical side of things. My mom was a big proponent on the medical side, worked in that industry for quite some time. But I was like, I love hanging out with kids, coaching basketball camps, coaching baseball camps. And I really loved what my mom's passion was on the medical side in her career. So that led me to pediatrician. I mean, the ability to take care of kids, sick kids specifically, kids with cancer is something that's still near and dear to my heart. Like, how do you heal children and get that smile back? That was my junior, senior year. It was like, there's nothing more that I want to do in life than this path.
Where did the pivot into marketing come from then? Because you didn't just pivot into marketing, you moved to Louisiana State.
Yeah, so it was because the side story is that the reason why I ended up at Louisiana College was to play basketball in college. It was a D2 school. It was my easiest path to pay for college and to play a sport that I loved. And, you know, again, that nod to my brother who coaches college basketball. It was kind of that accomplishment. Unfortunately, during my time at Louisiana College, tore my ACL, MCL, and all my ligaments. And respectfully to that university, I couldn't, in my right mind, stay in this very, very small town in college where my only reason was to play basketball and to get accepted in a med school. So the pivot happened after my ACL, MCL surgery.
Did you take a bit of time to think about what your next move would be?
No, I think it's, and that's a great question. I think for me, it was always, I never really wanted to be a pediatrician. I just loved that side of the space. You know, deep down in my heart, I'd always loved advertising. A unique thing, my brother and I, again, shared a room. We did this cool thing is every month, you know, because back then you got magazines, and every month when my mom's different magazine subscriptions would come in, my brother and I would cut them out. On top of it, we loved Calvin and Hobbes, which is funny. I purchased all of the comic books now, and they sit at my desk as well. But every month, what we would do is we would find all of these different advertisements in magazines that we loved. We would buy posters, obviously the Jordan, the flight one, where his arms are spread out. And what we would do is we would be bill posters. We would hang all throughout our room. It was blanketed with cutouts of Calvin and Hobbes. It was Absolute Vodka ads out of magazines. It was Nike ads. It was, you know, Coca-Cola ads. So I always loved the ad side of it. And I always thought it was unique on how something as simple as a magazine ad could really just transform you into this different space, which sounds really bizarre today in the digital world that we live in. But I always loved the ad side of the business. And I always loved that creativity. So really kind of pivoting more to, you know, my dad's side of being a photographer and really kind of storytelling on the image and visual side. So that was really that moment where I was like, okay, we have lost time here. Let's dive straight into what you truly love. And that is creativity, that is advertising, that is marketing.
And you continued with that passion after graduation because you started interning with AAA baseball teams. That must have been a blast for you.
Yeah, it was, again, always going, and I tell people this all the time, like, work where your passion is, right? So for me, the love of baseball, ever since I was a little kid playing this sport, excelling at it, you know, the opportunity to intern for a AAA baseball team that was the Astros affiliate, who I was a massive fan of, it was kind of like the dream job. You know, we would, the role was to basically interact with players on the PR side, you know, have them show up at events, to having those people evolve into, you know, how do we do on-field promotions? How do we tell stories to brands and have them be a part of a bobblehead doll giveaway? Or one of my greatest feats was selling a sponsorship where a guy would jump out of an airplane every Friday night and nice. Deliver the first pitch ball. So, yeah.
One of my professors in university, he was a sport management professor, but he did his PhD at the University of Massachusetts. He did it at UMass, and he interned and did work at minor league ball teams too. I think it was the South Bend Silverhawks and the Pittsfield Mets. And he had some crazy stories about that too, about trying to come up and brainstorm with the team what the different giveaway or event night should be. And it ranged from everything, like you said, to like crazy bobblehead night to like Star Wars night and so forth. And he said that would bring people in. Like they were really on board with that sort of stuff.
Yeah, another great book is Vec is in Rec, and he's actually the son of the very famous, and again, it's a great book and it's a great read, but why there's ivy on the Wrigley Field wall has a lot to do with Vec. And Vec became this like legend on having, you know, vinyl night where people were shattering vinyls all over Cubs Field to evolving into every minor league baseball program. It was like, what is the most bizarre thing that we can do? We're going to do it.
I was at one minor league baseball game about 2 years ago. It was for business, and it was the Arkansas Travelers. And I got to tell you, I like minor league ball fields because there's no such thing as a bad seat anywhere.
At all. And the experience is going to be unbelievable. And typically the ticket is very cheap. And funny that you say that, because a good friend of mine went on to work there for quite some time.
Oh, with the Travelers?
With the Travelers, yeah.
They've got some sort of Hispanic alter ego, and they do it certain nights of the year. And I forget the name of it, but it was absolutely ridiculous. And apparently people wear ponchos, giant hats, sometimes glorified mustaches to those evenings. Like, you don't see that at other sports. Like, definitely not at an NBA game, or let alone an NHL game.
Absolutely. And I think you see that now with the success of the Savannah Bananas that have traveled all around the U.S.
Yeah, that's crazy. They're like the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball.
Exactly.
You stayed within baseball, though. So after your internships, you moved into a director of marketing role with the New Orleans Zephyrs. So first off, tell us about the New Orleans Zephyrs. Like, who are they the affiliate to?
Yeah, at the time, you know, it was, again, we kind of skipped over the part, but before that, I interned with the Atlanta Braves, interned in Atlanta at this massive resort. So, you know, it was always kind of in the cards for me to work in marketing and in baseball. That was kind of my dream. And then eventually it was to pivot and create my own sports marketing agency. So the last team that I interned for, the director of marketing, you know, again, at the time I was 22 years old, way too young to have this job. Well, the former director of marketing left literally a month before the season started, and we were in a bind. And again, I just spoke up, stepped up, and got hired as the director of marketing at 22 years old. At the time, we were an Astros affiliate. They went on to become a Marlins affiliate, a Mets affiliate. And unfortunately, the team no longer is there. But yeah, that role was more, even more in depth. Like, okay, Ian, you've done some bizarre things. You know, we did a Christian invasion night where I invited every single Catholic church, every Baptist church, every Christian, every non-denominational church. And we sold out the ballpark on like a Tuesday night where we had like 11,000 people at the ballpark, and we called it Christian invasion night. And we had, you know, whatever the hot Christian band was. But yeah, I mean, that role was so much fun. I mean, I say I was babysitting Brad Lidge, Jason Lane. We had folks like Roger Clemens come through. We had so many players that would come through. Nolan Ryan would visit often. And, you know, again, it was the dream job, but it was a lot of work. And there's a lot of home baseball games, 82 plus games. And then during the offseason, you know, we had everything from Cirque du Soleil to, you know, a Harley Davidson takeover in the parking lot. So it was grueling work, but definitely the fondest memories that I have, and some of my closest friends working during that short amount of time working in minor league baseball.
Oh, so you were responsible for monetizing the stadium real estate in the offseason as well?
Oh, yeah. Always trying to make money. It was the name of the game there.
Okay, so as a baseball fan, do you find the pitch clock sacrilegious or a right step into modernizing the game?
I think we live in a world today where everything has to be faster and quicker. And, you know, what are you doing for me in the exact moment? I think it's sacrilegious. I think baseball should be this moment where you could sit there, and this is the story we would sell as well, and it's where I take my sons to LSU baseball games today. You know, it's that moment. It's not about just watching a baseball game. It's about slowing down, enjoying the moment in time, whether that's with, you know, a girlfriend, your son, your daughter, you know, your wife, a significant other, whomever it may be, maybe your dad. But everybody has the opportunity at a baseball game to just slow down life and just enjoy the moment. If you go to a baseball game today, very few people are actually paying attention to the baseball game. So, yeah, long-winded way, and it's one of my biggest pet peeves. I also think that outside of the camera, I think that phones should automatically turn themselves off and have people slow down a bit. So, yeah, speeding up the game, it's a bit wonky. I think the first season of the pitch clock, that was hilarious, watching pitchers just get absolutely agitated by that concept.
there's a lot of turnover in minor league players. Like the roster's got a lot of turnover because a lot of the players want to make it to the major leagues and people are going up and they're coming down all the time. Did that present a challenge for you when trying to market the team? Because you didn't know whether or not your star player would even be playing in the next game because they could get called up to the Astros.
Yeah, and that's something from day one. I know my strategy when I was there years ago, it was like, we're never going to rely on the players. We're actually not selling the product of a baseball game. We were always selling the experience, right? It's kind of funny. I have a mini billboard of the first ever billboard buy I ever did, was actually with a competitor. And the tagline says, your kid could catch something. And the concept behind that was, hey, they could catch something from a giveaway thrown off the dugout from our mascot to a potential foul ball. So we never really relied on the players. I think today's day and age with digital, it's a bit different. And again, I'm aging myself. Not that I'm that old, but, you know, again, we didn't have Twitter. We didn't have TikTok. We didn't have Instagram. So if we knew last minute that, you know, for example, Roger Clemens was flying in to pitch that night, today it would be a simple tweet. It would be, going back in the locker room and doing a TikTok video, or even buying a digital billboard last minute and say, hey, Roger Clemens is pitching tonight. We didn't have that luxury. It was kind of like newspapers are bought, billboards are bought. We did the radio show this morning. But yeah, it was never about the player. It was always about the experience. But I think that would have changed, and definitely probably does today, on the minor league level compared to the way that they, you know, the NBA, how they're focused on, you know, two key players matchups each night.
We're going to take a quick break. Enjoying this episode? Of course you are, or you wouldn't have made it this far. Compliment your listening experience by subscribing to the Media People newsletter at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or at mediapeople.beehive.com. It's a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or mediapeople.beehive.com.
Is it safe to say that love is the reason you left baseball and went to Lamar Advertising?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it as a high level, 100%, the deeper story plot is really my now wife is from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where our corporate headquarters are at Lamar. And again, baseball not being that far away, but an hour away, it was love probably for at the time my girlfriend, now wife, is the why I moved to Lamar. And Lamar at the time, I didn't realize it, but it was really out of necessity. Like, okay, my expertise is in advertising, and there were very few options in the capital city of Louisiana. You know, it was either go work at LSU, which I did prior to, and it was really kind of, I'll give a shout out to one of my mentors, our former CMO, Tommy Teeple. I knew his son. I annoyed his son until he had me over to dinner, and I annoyed his dad until he finally said, look, man, I don't have a full-time job, but I can give you an internship. So, you know, I said, perfect, rolled up my sleeves and began working at Lamar almost 19 years ago now.
Was there a lot to learn? Because this had to have been your first foray into out-of-home advertising, and you were probably learning all of the metrics for the first time.
I had a fairly good grasp on media at the time, especially working in baseball. So, you know, I knew the media landscape. It's funny because I thought, like, okay, I'm coming to work for this big corporate giant, you know, coming from working in baseball where, you know, the most dressed up you got was like a polo and khakis. And I rolled in the first day, Victor, in a suit, and I'll never forget this. Ran into an executive. I didn't know it at the time. And he was like, hey man, don't wear that to the office. Like, we don't wear suits here. So really, that part was fun. But yes, I think for me, it was the holy grail because it was advertising. I was learning through a fire hose of just information. You know, again, it's a legacy company. So I was learning, you know, who the key players internally were. I was learning how the media worked, how the out-of-home landscape worked. And again, at this time, Lamar had just started exploring large format digital out of home. And we were the first in this space. And I think when I first started, we had around 70 or so digital billboards, and it was very new to everyone in the advertising community. So from that aspect, I was very early on to be able to kind of learn as the industry and the agency side was as well.
Tell us about your promotion to Director of Digital Innovation and Sales Strategy. What did that entail, and how did it differ from what you were doing previously with Lamar?
Shout out to John Miller, who's our EVP of sales. He really kind of took me under his wing. I was very passionate about Lamar very early on, quickly. I fell in love with digital, the digital aspect of our business. And again, like I'd mentioned, it was the very early stages. I worked in a national sales role, but I really wasn't good at selling. Like I always jokingly say, like, I'm great at the storytelling aspect. And then like right before the sale, I'll be like, yeah, so like we should just give this to you because you're an amazing brand. Obviously that doesn't happen. So that promotion was really led more by like technology. It was led by like, okay, who's going to handle the education side of, and the evolution of digital billboards from a comms perspective? Who's going to be talking to the national brands and agencies? And I really kind of fell into it and raised my hand. You know, while I was trying to sell the digital billboards, there was a lot of questions. So I had the ability early on to come back to corporate and say like, hey, this is what's confusing to people. You know, how do we innovate this product? So it was really inherently like, well, nobody else is doing this and we've never had anyone. So I think by default, because I was in the room, I kind of landed in that role.
When you were introducing digital billboards to the market, because like you said, you were one of the first ones to do that, what were the apprehensions from the clients? Like, were any clients going, we don't know about this because what happens if the billboard breaks or if the power goes out? Because when you think about it, a typical billboard or transit shelter, if it's not electronic, you can't break those. I mean, sure, they can be vandalized, but otherwise they don't break. It's kind of like the debate between a book and a Kindle. An e-reader breaks, you can't read the book. And books in their original format don't break.
Yeah, that was less of a concern with the brands and agencies. The bigger concern was really around like, well, I've always owned the billboard. Now you're going to tell me that I'm one of six advertisers. It was really around sharing the space that we had to get past. And it was honestly a quick conversation. I think one of the things that we did great at Lamar, you know, my team and others, was really around the how do we innovate this? Like, how do we make this product different? Like, if it's just going to be a static ad with six other advertisers, then like, what's the point? So quickly in the early days, we with our team and what we call the NOC, the Network Operating Center, that's ran by Rachel Carroll and her team, you know, early on, I coupled myself alongside of them to better understand the tech side. But also it was really around like, okay, you know, can we tap in real-time data feeds to trigger weather? Can we have live tweets streaming live to the billboards? So it was always like, what more can we do? And a lot of that was driven by clients like ESPN that approached us and said like, yeah, we're not really big into out-of-home in general and definitely don't want to be a part of that digital product. And being curious, which is again kind of the theme, curious and passionate is kind of the theme of my journey. We said, well, don't you have live scores for your website? And they're like, well, yeah, of course we do. And we're like, well, what if we can ingest that data feed and stream live scores? And they were like, well, can you? And we went back to our NOC and went back and we collaborated and lo and behold, we ran the first ever live scores. The live Twitter feed is actually pretty funny. The quick story of it is Larry King, who was a prominent TV personality on CNN, had Ashton Kutcher on. And this was the early days of Twitter. And Ashton Kutcher challenged Larry King to see who could race to 1 million followers first, which now is quite comical because I think our nanny has 1 million followers on TikTok and Instagram today. But we said, wait, this is a cool opportunity. So we actually, without telling Ashton Kutcher, is we were all in on Team Ashton. So we took, 50 or 100 of our digital boards at the time across the US, one of the markets being Atlanta. And through a data feed, we streamed every one of Ashton Kutcher's tweets to the billboard, more as the test. And the ultimate, like, hell yes was when Ashton Kutcher retweeted a picture of his tweet on one of Lamar's billboards at a gas station in Atlanta. And we're like, okay, we're on to something. And now obviously we've evolved to where we stream live Instagram feeds, we utilize user generated content for brands. But again, in the early days, it was just really combating that was, well, you can do more with creative and you can be more in the moment, right place, right time with the right message, utilizing data and creativity in one.
Tell us about your promotion to director of digital growth. Like, what were your responsibilities now compared to what you were doing in your previous role?
Yeah, on the digital growth. And again, it's funny because it was really more just title changes and then just given the authority to make higher decisions. The digital growth promotion really was starting to hone in about 11 years ago. We met with a company called Vistar. They were touting that they could stream digital content and ads based off of data, very similar to programmatic advertising in the online space. And again, you know, being in charge of digital growth and innovation, it was always about test and learn new technology. So for that aspect of it, it was, the focus was, is okay, how do we deploy a digital, all of our digital, all 5,000 of our digital, or at the time, probably 2,700, how do we deploy these to where they can be purchased based off of data, impression-based buys, audience-based buys? And it was heads down. It was a tech learn. It was, how do we not make the same mistakes that were made on the online space? We obviously didn't want to race to the bottom. We also didn't want to cannibalize existing inventory and clients. But most importantly, how do we go after true digital dollars and brands that really want to target a mom with 2+ kids that is a health conscious consumer that has an affinity towards soccer? That was a space and universe that the out of home industry at the time just didn't live in. But again, Lamar being curious, you know, myself and the team and countless others inside of our corporate office here, we were just all in, like, let's test and learn this. So a big portion of that was, and the role and responsibility, and still is today, is that infancy of programmatic advertising in the out-of-home space.
Okay, so let's bring this full circle. How did the promotion to VP and GM come about?
Yeah, and again, that was more of a, okay, we're making huge decisions. At the time, we then integrated in with Place Exchange, our Canadian friends Hivestack and Broadsign. And, you know, for us and for that role was, okay, now we're making decisions that are going to impact the company. You know, so you need a VP role. And it was honestly, for me, it was a huge accomplishment. Again, going back to the early days of my life, you know, as I'd mentioned, my childhood was beautiful and amazing, but, you know, neither one of my parents graduated from college. So that was a massive accomplishment to become a VP at a publicly traded company, doing what I loved, going back to being 8, 9, 10-year-old Ian and Eric in the bedroom, being a bill poster, changing out every month, Absolute ads, Nike ads, to full circle now running the innovation in digital for, I would argue, the greatest out-of-home company that was and has ever been built.
So going back to day one at Lamar compared to today, how much has changed?
I would say a lot and a little. A little in the sense of the way that our company is structured, which I love. It's, you know, I started day one and Kevin Riley Jr. was our CEO. He is now our president and chairman. Fast forward to today, I report directly into Ross Riley and Sean Riley, our CEO. So I say nothing's changed because the people in this building is kind of the secret sauce of this company. There's been so many people day one, like a Monica Robinson, that introduced me to certain folks and to the evolution of, you know, push yourself beyond measures and you will be rewarded within the organization. So from a people perspective, nothing has really changed. It's people support people in this building. You know, how do we collaborate with each other? It's not about who accomplished what. It's about how did we make Lamar better? As far as day one to today, what's changed? You know, right off the bat for me personally, obviously having a beautiful office with all these great artifacts of artists and friends that I've met and industry folks over the years compared to day one when I shared a cube with four other people and thought that this was going to be a very short-lived career. That's obviously changed massively. And then just the industry as a whole, I think the beautiful part about what we do and the stuff that I get to touch in this space, it's a lot of fun, right? Because it's not just about Lamar, but it's about watching the industry as a whole evolve. I mean, if you look back day one, Lamar had the most roadside digital, and never in your life would you imagine that you would get inside of an Uber and there would be an ad, or you get inside of an elevator and there would be a dynamic ad playing, or you're in a health club. So watching the space evolve, watching a lot of the tech companies that are now passionate about being in this space have evolved. That part has significantly changed compared to day one here.
Ian, outside of your work at Lamar, you're also the host of the Digital Dirt podcast. What is the Digital Dirt podcast? How did it come about? And what do you guys talk about on it?
I'm very blessed. And it's what I love doing is storytelling. Is throughout my career, I get to, you know, keynote, speak on panels, go talk to brands and agency and just speak in front of large audiences. And what comes with that is obviously the phenomenal people that are not only in the out-of-home and advertising space, but also the brands that interact in our space. So the way that it came about is, you know, COVID hit and obviously there's no conferences. We're still all trying to scramble and figure out like, what does a conference look like on Zoom, which most were disasters. And my intern at the time, former employee, we'll give her a shout out, Claire, she came to me and she said, she's like, you've really met a significant amount of people throughout your career. And how great would it be if you could help tell their story and their journey and then let them share about their thought leadership piece? So something a little bit deeper. So we kind of collaborated. I was like, well, do you think people will listen to it? And, you know, what does the equipment look like? And she's like, let me handle this. You start to put together the lineup, put together the folks that are here. So the overarching premise of the podcast itself, which was birthed years ago, and we're entering now season six, is really around brands, tech companies, thought leaders in and outside of the space. And, you know, they kind of break the ice, tell a little bit about themselves, some fun facts. We talk deeply about their journey, where they started, and where they are today, very similar to the conversation today. And then we spend the bulk of the time talking about thought leadership, talking about specifically what they're honed in, their brand is focused on, whether it's corporate responsibility to, you know, how we started Gooder sunglasses and how that's evolved, and then the importance of culture. So it's really more than an out-of-home podcast, and it's more around, you know, the human and the person and their journey. So it really kind of helps people may say like, hey, I'm at that point in my career. Maybe I just need to keep at this a little bit more, or they learn a little bit more about that thought leadership piece. So it's really been a ton of fun. It's something that I enjoy so much is talking to people and learning more and just being curious about others.
And if anyone listening to this wants to listen to the Digital Dirt podcast, how can they go about doing it?
Yeah, it's on Spotify, Apple, Pandora, Google, any of the major podcast platforms. You can find it there.
Ian, this has been a fantastic chat. You ready for rapid fire questions?
Yeah, I love rapid fire questions.
The campaign you're most proud of?
Yeah, probably the campaign that I'm most proud of was, again, I kind of briefly mentioned Gooder sunglasses. The short of it is, and you can learn more about this about that campaign itself. It's amazing. A good friend of mine, she's the CMO, Kelly Puckett. You know, she came to me and said like, hey, our pseudo CEO is Carl the Flamingo. You wouldn't happen to have a billboard or a city where you have billboards in named Carl, do you? And lo and behold, there's a Carl, Georgia. There's 16 billboards in that market. And I love it because they literally are 185 people that live in Carl, Georgia. And Gutter took over all 16 billboards. They kind of tongue-in-cheek some cool ads, some 3D pop-outs, 2D embellishments with spangles. And it said, like, hey, Carl, me, Carl, our flamingo. Funny, we have the same name. They took it a step further. They flew into Carl, the founders, and the entire team, and they gave away 185 sunglasses to the local folks. And then, as if that wasn't ridiculous enough, they had their TikTok channel, Instagram channel, and they filmed Carl interacting with the mayor, Mayor Brock of Carl, Georgia, and kind of did this like tongue-in-cheek video that went viral on TikTok. So that was probably my favorite like creative campaign by far. And that wasn't rapid fire, my bad.
Your favorite movie?
Favorite movie, you know, again, nodding back to baseball. God, there's so many, but I'd probably say Field of Dreams is the best ever. And then The Sandlot from the other aspect of it.
No Major League or Rookie of the Year?
Nah, those are cheesy. Okay. Give me the heartfelt stories.
If Hollywood were to make a movie based on your life story, who would you want to play you?
He embeds my personality and my passion for like health and just being an odd, very animated individual. But I would say Rob Lowe from Parks and Rec, specifically that character. And I wish I looked like him. And one person, and I'll hang on to this forever, someone said I look like Zac Efron, which I do not at all. I'd have to say Zac Efron.
My follow-up, if Hollywood were to make that movie based on your life story, what would you call it?
Yeah, I think I'm not going to lie. Being a tech guy, and kind of sharing that my mom called me the future growing up because I was never satisfied. I did do a quick little ChatGPT search on it, and it came up with Beyond Tomorrow, A Journey into the Future. But it would be some variation of that title, probably more tongue-in-cheek slash serious slash comedic, I would say.
Here, I got one for you. You can take this for free. A play on Angels in the Outfield, Billboards in the Outfield.
Ah, there you go. Or Billboards, let's do this, Billboards on Mars, ties in the future. There we go.
Your favorite book?
I already mentioned Shoe Dog is one of my favorite. The other, I have a whole stack of books, but yeah, we'll say Vecas and Rec, Elon Musk, first autobiography, and then Shoe Dog.
Your favorite song?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Having 11-year-old triplets, I think it's whatever they want to listen to. But my nod to New Orleans is anything Lil Wayne sings.
The best advice you have ever received?
The best advice that I've ever received was do what you love, never take no as an answer, and continue to be passionate every day of your life.
My signature closing question, if you weren't in media, what would you be doing and why?
If I weren't in media, I would hopefully be wrapping up my career in Major League Baseball.
Ian, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Victor. This has been a blast.